Francis Garrigus, Barbara Smith, and Claude F. Gilson versus John Hardy and Apex Golf Properties Corporation. You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm here today representing the appellants Francis Garrigus, Barbara Smith, and Claude Gilson, who are the owners of property in the Faro Valley development. This case involves the reasonable expectations of property owners who purchase property that is the beneficiary of deed restrictions. The trial court in this case issued a judgment and granted declaratory relief approving amended restrictions on adjacent property to my client's property. We've raised numerous issues challenging the judgment. First, the judgment is void because it fails to describe the property affected by the Chapter 213 petition with reasonable certainty. Second, the defendant's motion for summary judgment did not conclusively establish that Chapter 213 applies. Third, the modified restrictions violate the common law mutuality doctrine. Fourth, the summary judgment failed to show that the petition circulator, Mr. Hardy, complied with Chapter 213. Fifth, the Chapter 213 itself violates the contracts clauses of the United States and the Texas Constitution. And finally, to the extent that the court reverses the judgment, it should also reverse the award of attorney's fees. So turning to the first argument, the judgment itself is void. It is uncontested in this case that a judgment affecting an interest in land has to provide a sufficient description of the property. Otherwise, the judgment is void.
But counsel, let me ask you that a question. Doesn't the authority that you rely on in your brief relate to conveyances? Are you aware of any authority that requires a specific description of land within a clearly specified tract for which a restrictive covenant applies?
Yes, Your Honor. We have cited a case in our briefing called Keith versus Seymour. In that case, the court held that a restricted covenant was subject to the same description requirements as other conveyances, and there are numerous cases that describe restrictive covenants as a type of easement. A negative easement, which is an interest in property, and so the appellee's argument that those rules don't apply because this is not a technical conveyance is wrong according to that case law.
In the case that you're citing, is that restrictive covenant contained in the deed itself or is it conveyed in a deed like in this case where is not necessarily give ownership to your clients?
I believe in that case, in the Keith versus Seymour case, it was contained in resolutions that were not very specific and did not provide a description of the property subject to the restrictions at all. And so the court declared that the restrictive covenant was unenforceable. Your Honor, the court has set aside numerous judgments. That's the other problem, is not only do we have a Chapter 213 petition that imposes restrictions that that does not provide a sufficient description, but the actual judgment itself affects the interest in land, and the Texas Supreme Court has said that the description of property in a judgment has to comply with the sufficiency requirements and the adequacy of the description. And the reason is simple, because these judgments, these conveyances, documents relating to an interest in property are filed in the property records, and those who would be searching the property records have to be able to identify the property that's subject to the restrictions. And without an adequate description, you simply can't do that. And so the Texas Supreme Court and the lower courts have repeatedly struck down deeds and judgments with language that is similar to what's the Chapter 213 petition and judgment in this case. For example, judgments and deeds that say a certain amount of acreage out of a larger amount without describing with meets and bounds or some identifiable reference point where the boundary of the property could be located, those descriptions have been held inadequate, and that is exactly what we have here. We have an amended covenant that says not more than 42 acres of land fronting on Ennis Jocelyn Road. Well, you can't tell where the boundaries of that property lie, and so that description is inadequate. The restrictions off the amended restriction says a minimum of 16 acres to be used as tennis courts and parking and an expanded lake. It doesn't describe anywhere in those documents where that particular acreage will be located.
So in the map that you've provided, or somebody provided, I got this out of the record somewhere, it shows a section that's the proposed, is it Barissa?
I'm sorry?
How do you pronounce that? Is it the Barissa?
Or the Barisi.
Barisi.
I believe that's correct.
Proposed Barisi Village Development. So that designates the area where this was going to, or potentially will be developed.
But it still does not provide a meets and bounds description. So that map, you could look at it and get a general sense, but you have no meets and bounds description and no way to bind the owner of the property to actually comply with the restricted covenant because you couldn't tell if it was in compliance or not.
Okay. I'd like to jump to the issue with regard to the language adjacent to, because I think that's really important here. On this same map, you show where the parties that are involved here, the three plaintiffs, where their properties are. And am I correct that the Smiths and the Gilsons are part of the condominium complexes? Do they live there? Or
I believe they have single family residential.
Okay. All right. Well,
I'll double check when I sit down. But well, it's a large record.
That's where it points to Carriage Park and to Rock Creek. Are those the condominium regimes? Or
those are the condominium regimes. Okay. I'm looking at my co-counsel, but he's not looking up at me.
Okay. So my question was going to So is your argument then if they're condominium in these complexes is right next to the property, then they didn't have a right to vote, but it's the ones more in the interior on the other side of the complexes that didn't have a right to vote. Is that your position?
That's correct.
Okay. So
that's
then my question was going to be if the Smiths and the Gilsons were right on the edge there.
Yes. Their property does abut the golf course.
But doesn't everybody that has an ownership in the condominium, I guess in the condominiums, also have a percentage of ownership in the common areas, which are adjacent to this parcel of land in question?
They do have an undivided interest in the common areas. However, the case law has said that does not give them enforcement rights. Or rights to act on behalf of the condominium regime to enforce rights,
cited the Meyer v. Cuevas case. It says that the unit owners have no individual property right in the common areas for which they can sue for damages. And so, what you're arguing here is that because they don't have a right to sue for damages, they likewise don't have a right to claim an interest in this. This property in order to participate in this process, I guess. Is that what you're saying? Is it the same thing, really?
Yes. It makes logical sense because if you don't have standing as an individual owner of an undivided interest in a common element, if you don't have – it really, in that case, it was a standing issue. Did they have standing to file a suit on
– don't you concede that the ones that are facing the golf course have a voting right? Is one of the arguments that you conceded in your brief?
Yes, if they are abutting the golf course property, yes. But
so would that mean if they're just facing it, or if only the first floor? Because then, if you take that argument a little bit farther, then only the ones that are immediately adjacent or on the first floor would have a voting right. And to me, that might sound absurd.
I think that if their property touches the golf course and there's nothing in between, that is our position. There's
even,
nothing in
between.
How about
if you have to look at it?
I'm sorry?
How about if the people that have a view of the golf course or the view of the, if the development of, you know, occurs, a view of the commercial area, wouldn't they also have an interest?
Well, so the deed itself, the 1971 deed, is what gives the right to enforce the deed restriction. And it describes the beneficiaries of the restriction as those owners that are adjacent to the property. So the land that's owned has to be touching with no barrier in between. And so that's our position. So you may have property that backs up off of it and still be able to see the golf course. But if you're not touching the golf course, then you don't have a right to enforce the deed restriction. And if you look at our brief, we've highlighted how the single family residences, the condo units that are abutting Apex, and then the apartment complexes, if only those had been counted, they would have not met the threshold. I'd like to take a minute before I run out of time to talk about compliance with Chapter 213, and that it actually does not even apply to this case. The motion for summary judgment that was granted by the trial court was a traditional summary judgment motion filed by the defendants, which means that they had to conclusively establish their entitlement to the relief requested. And so to be able to do that and obtain a declaratory judgment that the Chapter 213 petition was valid, initially they had to establish that Chapter 213 applied. This is an argument that cannot be waived. The Clear Creek Basin case clearly says, and Texas Supreme Court has repeatedly held, that if a summary judgment motion, a traditional summary judgment motion, is legally insufficient, that that issue can be raised for the first time on appeal, and you don't even have to file a response in the trial
court.
Shouldn't
the specifics of your argument have been brought to the attention of the trial court?
Your Honor, not if the motion itself is legally insufficient. No response would have been required to raise this argument. And so to analyze this argument, all you have to do is look at the definitions in Chapter 213. The amenity property is defined as real property, the use of which is restricted by a dedicatory instrument to use as a golf course or a country club. And then dedicatory instrument really is where the problem lies for the appellees. The requirements to have a dedicatory instrument are that it restricts property to use as an amenity property, that it designates beneficiaries in the development, and that's a critical word. All three requirements must be met. It must address the establishment, maintenance, and operation of the amenity property. The 1971 deed does not address this last requirement, and so by the definitions found in Chapter 213, Chapter 213 does not apply at all, and so their relief was erroneously granted. And then furthermore,
so if Chapter 213 does not apply, is there any other remedy? I'm assuming there isn't any other statute that helps these homeowners.
No,
if they want to do something.
Then you default to the common law rule, which is to modify restrictions on property. All of the beneficiaries and owners of the property have to agree. It has to be unanimous.
Wasn't the statute created for the benefit of this particular property?
The legislative history would suggest that it was, but when the plain language shows that it does not apply, we're bound by that. And the legislature was careful to include in its definitions these requirements for maintenance of the amenity property and operation of the amenity property, and this deed does not get you there. And so Chapter 213 does not apply, and the default rule does apply. I don't want to...
The appellee has listed a few examples of what they argue as some type of maintenance or operation. What else would have to be in there?
The maintenance and operation that they have referred to refers to a reservation in the initial deed of a mineral rights interest in the original grantor. Whereas the real property, the surface property, was deeded to the development with the restriction. And so the maintenance and operation that they're talking about is not talking about the maintenance and operation of the amenity, the golf course and the country club. It's relating to mineral interests that were reserved in the grantor. So those don't satisfy the requirement. The statute's clear. It's talking about maintenance and operation of the golf course and the country club, and that's not addressed in the deed. And so Chapter 213 does not apply. I'm sure the court has more questions on mutuality, but I see my time is running up, and I don't want to be unable to address that on reply.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I have some maps for the court if it would be of assistance to the court to have them, and I was told I need to ask you folks about how to get them to you.
Sure, you can just come up and hand them to us. We don't bite.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I have a prepared talk that I'm more than happy to do, but it's very clear that you folks have read the briefs and have certain areas that interest you. And so I am going to kind of vary from it and try to address some of the things that you addressed with the appellants, unless you would like me to respond to something else.
Well, let's talk about waiver. Your argument on, well, her last argument on whether or not, well, I guess your argument is that they waived that argument because they didn't raise the applicability of the 213 statute.
Absolutely. They did not address that. In fact, if you look in the motions for summary judgment, they all say Chapter 213 applies to this property. There was no way on earth we knew we needed to prove that. It looked like it was an agreed proposition. And furthermore, it relies on fact issues. If you don't bring those fact issues up, then you've waived it at this point. Also, Rule 166A requires you to bring these things up to the trial court so the trial court can address them. In addition, we think even if we didn't waive it, all the statute requires is that it address these things when it basically said this has to be a country club, you can have these other buildings or types of things on it. We think it addressed all three of those issues as well. It says it has to.
As a matter of law, determine its applicability? I mean, it's based on the deed itself and what's in the deed and as to whether it meets the requirements of the statute.
If you're going to interpret the deed, that's, I believe you could do it as a matter of, or if you believe the deed is totally unambiguous and you don't need to interpret the deed, you can probably do it as a matter of law. And if you do that, we believe that you will find for us that it does address maintenance, operation, and establishment, because it talks about what the uses can be consistent with a country club. Maintenance doesn't mean necessarily repair. Maintenance means continuation as well. So we don't believe that there's any question that this deed addresses those things. And if, as they say, this is specifically supposed to address this property, then I would be hard-pressed to believe that the legislature didn't believe it applied to it, although we believe that the statute is a little broader than that.
It seems like that was their intent. I know it came about because of this property, but they were trying to make it broad to where it could be. I'm assuming it hasn't been used in any other case.
Not that I know of, Your Honor. I do know in the hearings they addressed another golf course, and of course we have evidence that the King's Crossing golf course had failed the year, the country clubbing and golf course had failed the year before this. And in terms of the specificity of the statute, we would point out that there are many, many laws on the books. Practically chapters 200 through 213 address covenants and restrictive covenants and how you can extend them if that's not provided, how you can terminate them if that's not provided. There's a statute that specifically says a single family, housing, restrictive covenant can't be enforced if you're trying to put mental retardation, family homes in that property. And those provide no vote, nothing. They just basically say, we think this is for the good of the state. We're going to do this. Too bad if you have a restrictive covenant. Too bad if you have an expectation, which is consistent with Texas law. Texas law regulates property use, property ownership, all over the place. I mean, we have an entire property code, and as I said, a good portion of Chapter 200, the 200 through 213, addresses restrictive covenants. And there are cases that basically say that's a heavily regulated area. You have an expectation to have your use of that affected by zoning ordinances, state regulations, and sometimes even federal regulations. So this statute may have filled a gap in some of those covenants, I mean, in some of those statutes, in order that they looked at this and said there's not a statute this falls under. That's pretty clear from the statute itself, where they say if you fall under these other statutes, this statute does not apply. This is kind of a gap filler statute for something that fell through the cracks. So I think that it does apply to this property. I think that the dedicatory instrument does make that. I think they have waived that argument anyway.
I just want to ask you that then, are you saying that in the restrictive covenant itself, that no use shall be permitted upon said property other than a country club and so forth and so on, you can imply that it's also that you're to establish it, maintain it, and operate that amenity property?
Correct.
You're saying you don't need a specific portion in that restrictive covenant that outlines how you have to operate it?
I believe that's correct. The statute uses the term address. That's the word used in the statute. That doesn't mean you have to provide an outline. It doesn't mean you have to provide a time schedule. It doesn't mean any of those things. It just means you have to address it. Say, basically, you're going to establish it, you're going to maintain it, and you're going to operate it.
Let me ask you a question. Going back to their argument that it's not specific enough, that the legal description was not specific enough, I guess my question then becomes, were the maps that the justice referred to include, I guess this one, I guess I can show it to you. Was this attached to the judgment? Do you know if it was or not?
This map is attached to the judgment, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's found at, there's 4374 and 4375. Okay. What is it? First off, the judgment contains the legal description of the property affected, which is the amenity property. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And the Keith versus Seymour case that they discussed does not require a specific location on a property for a restrictive covenant to apply. The problem in the Keith versus Seymour case is they had a restrictive covenant and they wanted it to apply to various parcels of property that they were conveying. Again, they were conveying these properties. And the restrictive covenant and the deeds did not identify which parcels of property it was going to apply to. So in essence, essentially, it is, one, a conveyance case, and two, again, you have to identify with specificity the property to which the restrictive covenant applies. But that doesn't mean you have to say that we're going to restrict fences to exactly, you know, this meet, this bound on properties. You can say anywhere 25 feet from the border. You can do all of that. It doesn't have to say exactly where those things are going to be. And so we don't, number one, the judgment has a legal description in it. It has the petition attached to it as attachment A. If that's not enough, the petition also refers to the PUD, which does have meets and bounds in it. So I mean, by reference, you can tell where it is, and that has also been found to be acceptable under Texas law. So we don't think that the argument that the judgment is void has any validity whatsoever.
What about the argument that the impact is discriminatory in the sense that some people that live in a certain part of the neighborhood are going to continue to have their view of a golf course, whereas others are going to have what appears to be, you know, a bustling business development, because the list of uses is pretty broad. I mean, they can build just about anything there, it seems like.
You can, although the plan is with the PUD, Your Honor. And I will point out that essentially, number one, this is the beneficiary properties are established by the deed. The deed upon which the appellants are relying establishes who the beneficiary properties are. And I know the question came up about the word adjacent. To me, that is not the real issue. The real issue is, what is real property? And there's no question that there is real property owned by the condominium regimes that is adjacent to this property.
But they're using that interest to their benefit in this case, whereas in the case law cited by appellants, those that did not give the owner standing to pursue any damages. How can it work both ways?
Okay, because essentially that's like a shareholder derivative suit. Essentially, in those condominium regimes, the power to sue and on behalf of the common elements was given to the council. It was not in the individual rights. In these condominium regimes, the owners of the units own that real property, regardless of whether that were the case in those cases, and that is the case in those cases. Essentially, this is not a suit for damages from the real property. Essentially, the deed establishes who the beneficiary properties are and who can sue for it. Okay, it's done by the deed itself. And then the statute is where the voters' rights come from. The statute determines who of this development can vote. And that's done in 213.001 and 213.008. And there may be a couple in between that also affect that. But they basically establish that owners of units in the condominiums regimes can have a vote. And so the vote is given by the statute in terms of how you change the restrictions. The deed establishes who the beneficiary properties are, and the beneficiary properties are referred to in the statute, but they specifically give unit owners of the condominiums a vote by the definition in 213.001.
Well, and all the condominium owners, regardless of whether they're physically adjacent, have an interest in the common areas and pay taxes on the common areas.
Correct. Maintenance.
And actually it's part of their deed.
Correct.
In their deed that has a description of, if it's a standard condominium ownership, they also have a deed. In their deed, it contains that description of the common areas as part of their ownership rights. Is that correct?
And the declarations are in the record, Your Honor, and the Rock Creek condominium. I mean, you can pull up the Rock Creek condominiums, and it specifically says unit owners own part of the areas, the common areas. The maps that I've provided to the court, let me just run through those real quickly, and I don't know if this will help or not. The statute requires a 75% approval of the change. The statute specifically states that there are three categories of votes. There are yes votes, no votes, and non or absent votes. And I've called them absents just because non-votes gets a little confusing. And tab A basically shows you all of the people who voted against it, okay? That is the total sum of people who voted against this petition project. There were 20 of them. There are 355 total qualified voters and 10 votes that are no votes. Because there's a supermajority required, the second map under tab 1 shows you all the votes that get counted as no votes. These are the votes where people did not return the petitions. There is no vote on file for these residences. There's no record of any vote. And that comes out to a total of 59, more than twice the number of people who voted no, just simply didn't vote. The third map in the tab shows all of the votes as tabulated. The green are all of the votes for this petition. And the numbers are over here, but the total votes on the left-hand side is 355, 296 voted for. That's 83% of the neighborhood. And the voter turnout rate was, I believe, something like 90%, which, you know, if we could get that in our elections here, we'd all have a country that cared about who was elected, I guess.
And Council, looking at that map, out of curiosity, which were the ones that would be, where the intended use is this commercial development?
And that is in the record, Your Honor. I don't have the page number. But essentially what you will find is the tennis courts, which is the big square up top with the one green dot in it.
Okay.
Those tennis courts are still there. Nothing changes there.
Okay.
The golf course, nothing changes on the left of Nile.
Okay.
In the area between the tennis courts and Nile are going to be housing. It's all housing with the exception of a memory care center to help to establish assistance for Alzheimer's patients.
Mm-hmm.
There is assisted living in that area, and then there is independent living in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So that central area is all going to be residential again. And this already is a mixed-use community. I mean, we already have multifamily, single family, and there's commercial on the other end. All of the commercial activity is going to be on the end with Ennis Joslyn, where the Seaside Villa condominiums are, where the apartment complexes are, and some maybe where the condominium owners are, but that's going to all be on the right-hand side. There is a drawing, if the court finds in the record, the PUD. It has the plan for the development attached to it, and that will have it. Under tab 2, Your Honor, we took the issue of the border properties only and provided the votes for the border properties only, the total of border properties, and this is put forth in the summary judgment motion that the appellants filed. 163 properties total. There are still 129 votes for, which is a 79% approval rating on that one. So even just doing the border properties, this petition still passes and goes forward.
And that includes from Seaside Villa and Carriage Park and Rock Creek, only the ones?
Only
the
highlighted in yellow.
The highlighted in yellow, okay.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, I took one that allowed all the condominium regimes to vote. Oh, excuse me. There was an argument at some point about the condos should have to vote as one vote if they all own that property together. And so I did that calculation, Your Honor. And we still have an 81.4% vote. If the condominiums vote based on a majority, then you still have an 81% vote.
These other houses that didn't vote that aren't adjacent, were they still part of the PUD that was created, I guess, years ago when they
Sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure what you're asking me.
Well, the other houses that are not adjacent to the golf course, were they part of the PUD when they originally someone would have had to apply for PUD?
For the
proposed whole development?
Originally. Your Honor, I don't have that information. I don't believe that's in the record. What I can tell you is there was an 18-hole golf course and that the country club, that the tennis courts are between Luxor Drive and Karnak Drive. And I actually am not that familiar with what was there. There's pretty much nothing there. But I will point out that under the original restrictions, things consistent with a country club could include skeet shooting or clay pigeon shooting. It could include a dancing area, a dance hall. It could include tennis courts with Klieg lights. It could include a lot of the things that could include stores. It could include some mercantile advisors, and it could include homes. There are country clubs with homes in them. And so the expectations on this are not that different. And further, if you look at the plan, you will see that there is 100 foot of green space guaranteed around all the single family homes, the homes as opposed to just the condominiums and the apartments. But there's 100 feet of green space designed around all single-family dwellings.
Council, let's talk about the constitutional challenges. You contend that there's really no impairment to the homeowner's contract rights. How does the statute, how is their status of beneficiaries of the deed restriction not a contract right?
Well, it is not a substantial impairment of any contract right. First off, I'm not a whether there's privity or not is a whole other question. But essentially, Your Honor, what happens on that is, and there's an affidavit I think that the plaintiffs put forth that said somebody paid $5,000 more for a golf course. Compared to nice homes on a golf course, that's not much money. That's really not a substantial impairment. Furthermore, the statute is a procedural statute. The statute did not take away the covenant. The vote provided and outlined by the statute provided that. And procedural laws generally are not considered to be impair contracts or contractual rights. In addition, are you specifically asking about the substantial impairment part, or do you want me to go on to the rest of it as well?
The rest of it.
Okay. The legislature established the findings that establish it as a police power and for the welfare of the community, which is recognized in many, many cases as an appropriate exercise of the police power. And it is directly, in fact, in some ways, the appellants would say it's too directly tailored to this particular incident, as we've already argued, but it's very clearly tailored. But because it is a procedural right, because those people still have the property, they live in the property, they bought a house, the house is probably worth more than the land was anyway, it is not a substantial impairment. Their view may have 100 feet of trees out the window instead of an entire golf course, but it will be a nicely maintained 100-foot view instead of armadillos and raccoons crawling all over the cement blocks that are there now. To that end, I would also point out that property use is one of the most heavily regulated areas in Texas, and one of the Energy Reserve case specifically says if it's a highly regulated area, you really don't have an expectation that you can enjoy this property without any change whatsoever. I don't have any more time. Thank you, Your
Honor.
Thank you.
I want to spend my rebuttal time talking about mutuality and then also the constitutional challenges since we didn't get into them before. Justice Contreras, I think you asked whether the application of these restrictions is being put forth in a discriminatory manner, and they are. And that really touches on the mutuality doctrine. The common law doctrine of mutuality, what it does is it preserves those reasonable expectations that property owners have when they purchase property that is part of a planned development, and that's what we have here. When a developer plans a development like this with a subdivision and in a golf course, usually they have a big plat and they have their map that shows where everything's going, and they have all their lots centered around the central piece of the subdivision, which in this case was the golf course. And so the mutuality doctrine comes in and says you cannot amend restrictions that are in a development like that unless the amendment applies uniformly to everyone. And the purpose of that is to prevent the discrimination that's happening in this case, where a group of homeowners are restricting or changing the restrictions on property that affects others in another area of the subdivision. And if you look at that map that was provided, the majority of the votes for the amended restriction were on property that was not going to get changed.
The map that she provided under tab 2, counting only the border property, still mm-hmm. shows 79%.
Well, the majority of those are all to the left side of the map, whereas the new development will be towards the right side of the map.
What you're saying. Yeah,
right. So all the people
on the other side of Nile Drive
right.
are not as impacted as the ones. Okay.
Right. So people like Mr. Hardy, who circulated the petition, he testified that he expected to have a water feature and a golf course behind his property, whereas my clients will have a shopping center and a veterinary clinic and, you know, massage therapists and all things that they never expected. And that's what the mutuality doctrine really does protect.
Counsel, and you're relying on the Cent case, I guess, for that argument that you're making?
Yes, partly. And, you know, the Cent case has been recognized as pretty well established law in Texas, and there are numerous cases that have relied on it. And then around the country, the doctrine of mutuality has been recognized. And so,
but doesn't that case appear to limit the common law mutuality argument or doctrine to situations where multiple properties have the same restriction?
In that case, that was the fact scenario, but I don't believe that it's limited to that circumstance. And there are other cases, like the Wiley case that we cited, which was a group of homeowners seeking to enforce restrictions on property that was being used by a church. And those restrictions didn't apply to the homeowners, but they were still entitled to enforce them. So, and that's where appellees get into trouble, because they've really conflated mutuality of enforcement and mutuality of the obligations and the benefits with mutuality of obligation. In other words, they think that the only way that you can enforce a covenant is if you have the exact same covenant that operates against you, and that's just absolutely not correct. And there are numerous cases that we've cited where that has not barred the enforcement of a covenant. And then the cases also talk about implied mutuality when you're part of a development like this.
Well, are there any requirements of the homeowners that own adjacent properties to participate as members in the country club or in the golf course or anything that where you could say, well, there's some mutuality in that the golf course has to be a golf course and they are obligated to somehow contribute to its maintenance or viability, I guess.
Well, I think that hits on the second part of our argument with regard to mutuality is the defendants have made this blanket statement in their petition that there is no mutuality of obligation. In other words, there's no obligation on the homeowners. Mm-hmm. And they make that statement without putting in any evidence of what the restrictions are that apply to the homeowners. For example, the preclusion of fencing along the abutting property. May I conclude my
Please.
Answer? Typically in a subdivision like this with a golf course, the golf course is dedicated, the property abutting it, they're not allowed to erect fences to obstruct the view. And I believe that the deed restrictions in this case do contain those restrictions. They're just not in the record. The deeds that are in the record do refer to existing restrictions on the residential property, but the defendants did not put that in the record, and so they did not conclusively prove their argument that the mutuality doctrine doesn't apply because there's a lack of mutuality of obligation. So, so for that reason, the summary judgment should be reversed.
I do have one question with regard to the societal interests that have been argued here. It seems that your position is that these homeowners should not be able to make this change, but there's evidence that the golf courses. I mean, I haven't seen it, but from what it's being described as, it's just not a nice view anymore. It's not being used. It's not economically feasible for this company to continue to operate a golf tournament, a golf course. So isn't that of interest to society to improve that property if it can be improved?
So the governmental interest analysis, really the purpose of even conducting that analysis is to ensure that the government is validly exercising their police power.
Correct.
For a broad societal public welfare interest, not exercising powers to help special interests, which that's exactly.
So you're saying that this entire subdivision itself is not broad enough.
Right. And then also the stated goals and the justifications that the legislature put forth in the statute for adopting the statute speak in terms of May. There was no evidence that that no one could get financing to get the golf course and the country club running again. There was no evidence that it was truly cost prohibitive, that no one would ever use it, and this property was just going to lay waste forever. All of the interests that the legislature set forth were all speculative, and courts have said that that's not good enough to justify a severe undermining of contractual rights.
One more question. Okay, but just time frame. They closed the golf course in 2010. Okay, the legislature, I mean, there were, I guess, a big gap in there where there was nothing going on, where there were, it was no longer a golf course. It was just sitting there. And at that point, did any homeowners file suit or in trying to force them to build a golf course? Or because, I mean, couldn't they have done that at that point?
Well, so the deed says that it can't be used for anything other than a golf course or a country club, but it doesn't, and this goes back to whether Chapter 213 really even applies, because it doesn't establish an obligation on the party owning the property that that has the golf course. It doesn't establish an obligation for them to actually operate the golf course or the country club. It just says it can't be used for anything but that. So the expectation is it's either going to be a golf course, it's going to be a country club, or natural property, but not these commercial uses that are now being proposed in the mixed use development. Thank you.
Thank you. Interesting case. It'll be under submission. You are excused.